Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Geek Town Behind the Scenes podcast. I'm your host, Dave Elliott, and on this episode, I'm chatting with the cinematographer and camera operator, Bertie Gregory. When I spoke to Bertie for the interview, he was a BAFTA nominee for his work on the BBC series Seven Worlds, One Planet. However, as of yesterday, he is now a BAFTA winner for his incredible work on the Nature series along with his team. So huge congratulations to them. At only 26, Bertie has made a name for himself as one of the youngest and most sought-after wildlife filmmakers in the business. Along with Seven Worlds, he's contributed his talent to a variety of wildlife projects, including producing and hosting for the National Geographic online series Wildlife Resurrection Island and Wildlife The Big Freeze, which you can find on YouTube. In the interview, Bertie discusses his route into wildlife photography at such a young age, along with his unique behind-the-camera perspective on shooting wildlife. We chat about filming spectacle bears in South America, walking with big cats, and also using his vocal talents to attract a rather interesting audience. If you'd like to hear more behind-the-scenes interviews, don't forget to subscribe to wherever you get your podcast by searching for Geek Town Radio. This will also give you our weekly Geek Town Radio podcast, which gives you all the latest TV, filming, and gaming news. You can also go to our website at geektown.co.uk for the latest news stories and all the latest UK and US TV premiere dates. Here's the interview with Bertie, and I begin by checking in on how somebody who spends most of his time in the wilderness is coping with lockdown.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, Dave. How's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. Good to chat.
Yeah. Whereabouts are you?
I live in Bristol.
Oh, okay. Cool. For somebody like you that spends their entire life flying around to various different places, this must have been a nightmare getting locked down.
It's all relative, right? I could be, could be a lot worse. But it has been challenging. I mean, work-wise, basically the whole wildlife film industry has, all the overseas filming has just had a big pause button hit on it.
Yeah.
So that's a bit scary. And then sort of on a mental well-being level, I haven't spent this much time in one place or in the UK since I went professional, when I was at university, which was more than 6 years ago.
Jeez.
So, it's been interesting. Although, I'm a positive person and I like trying to find silver linings even in difficult times. And I've got to re-know a lot of British wildlife that I grew up with.
Yeah.
And slightly embarrassingly, I don't really film British wildlife professionally. Like it's not out of choice. I just haven't been given that work.
Yeah.
And so it's been nice in a way to sort of reconnect with that and remember why I got not interested in wildlife in the first place. So small little silver lining. Generally, though, yeah, it's not been great.
Yeah, yeah. Out in the garden filming like local squirrels and stuff.
Well, I mean, British wildlife, you know, we do have some really cool stuff.
Yeah.
It's just, I guess, not quite as well known as some other places. Like, I'm just about to try and film blue sharks off the coast of Wales.
Oh, wow.
Which would be really cool. Yeah, really charismatic species of shark, which we have in Britain. How cool is that?
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, you forget that there are things like sharks around the edge of Britain. You don't really think about it very much. Yeah. Oh, that's very cool. The show that you've been working on most recently, the Seven Worlds, One Planet one. In full disclosure, I've only seen a couple of episodes of it. I was going to watch some more today, and then my 81-year-old father had an iPad crisis. So
I think that's a pretty reasonable excuse.
So but I watched the Antarctica and the North America episodes last night.
That's good ones to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're good fun. I don't know if you remember the making of in the North America episode.
Yes.
Where quite embarrassingly I sung Adele on BBC One. Yeah. Fortunately, they actually cut out the bit where I was actually singing for real. That would have been the end of my career quickly.
You're missing out the important point of that. You sung Adele to Wales.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what was said in that making of is completely right. It's completely true. They are a really vocal animal and they're really curious. And if you sing, they come closer to you.
Yeah.
Which when I was told, I thought someone was just having me on and they just wanted me to look silly, which is fine. But no, it genuinely works. You stop singing, they swim off. You start singing, they come over. So yeah, that was critical to getting shots. What? Yeah. So it was Adele and Jurassic Park worked really well.
Awesome.
National Anthem and Star Wars, they were less keen on.
Well, you know, I was going to say clearly they have good taste, but you know, you can't knock John Williams. I mean, yeah. So before we get into the details of those episodes, start off with a little bit of background. I mean, you're what, 26 years old. How did you end up getting into the industry at such a young age and filming on shows with David Attenborough? I mean,
So I've always been obsessed with wildlife. My family are really into water sports. So I, from a really early age, was always thrown into the sea, mainly around on the Cornish coast, and always encouraged to surf and things like that. And I think when you spend that amount of time outside, you sort of gain an appreciation of nature sort of passively, like by osmosis.
Yeah.
So I was always, I guess, exposed to wildlife. When I was in my early teens, I grew up near Reading, and I started to really get into the wildlife that was near to me. So there was some farmers' fields down the road from the town that I was in, and I sort of got into sneaking up on roe deer and kingfishers and animals like badgers, and I just got completely obsessed with it. And everyone thought I was a complete weirdo, but I didn't really mind because I was having a great time. And when I was about 13 or 14, I realized that if I took pictures of what I saw, I started nicking my dad's camera. He had like a little compact camera. I started to realize that not only was this, if I took pictures of what I was seeing, it was a great way of like channeling my obsession, but it was also a good way of explaining where I'd been and showing people that thought I was a weirdo, like what I'd been up to. And I got a real buzz out of getting other people excited about what I was excited about. So I think that's how it started. And I started entering sort of young wildlife photography competitions and won a few of those. And through a long series of events that I won't bore you with, because of one of those competition wins, got to meet a National Geographic photographer called Steve Winter. He's like their big cat specialist. So any National Geographic story that you might have seen that had snow leopards or tigers or mountain lions in, he's the guy. And he was looking for a new assistant, and I was in the right place at the right time. Yeah. I said the right thing. I'd had the right experience for what he wanted. I was super keen. He offered me a job, basically. So I went to Bristol University. I studied zoology, and it was in my last year that I met Steve. And he basically said, as soon as you finish, you're hired. So I had to leave my graduation early to go home to pack to then start working for him. And the first, I spent 2 years working for him, 2.5 years. We went all over the place filming leopards and jaguars. So that was, it was a crazy sort of Willy Wonka golden ticket moment.
Wow.
And that was sort of my route into the industry.
That's amazing. Working on Seven Worlds, One Planet, your cameraman and your cinematographer for it. I mean, on most shows, when I talk to cinematographers, there's like, you know, I do a lot of narrative stuffs and dramas and things, and there's like two cinematographers. There's 51 cinematographers listed on this show. So, I mean, I'm assuming that's basically all the camera people, because I guess on a situation like that, the people behind the camera kind of double up as the cinematographers in most cases as well.
Yeah, it's the same person, basically. So the reason there's so many is because the shooting ratio that we have is huge. So generally, we spend about 4 to 6 weeks in the field for every 3 to 4 minutes of television.
Wow.
So if you've got a 2-year filming window and you've got 7 episodes, each is an hour long, each has 10 to 12 sequences in it, that's, you know, 10 to 12 times 6 weeks times 7 episodes in 2.5 years. A lot of shoots are going on at the same time.
Yeah.
So typically there'll be 1 or 2 cinematographers per shoot. And yeah, that's sort of how it's broken down. And then we'll have a director, someone from production, because all the cinematographers are freelance. So the directors are staff. And yeah, we'll go off and try and get the goods.
Well, yeah. I mean, in terms of doing that, what sort of plan do you have to go into a shoot? Because, you know, obviously with drama or comedy or something like that, there is a very obvious script to it. And when you're dealing with wildlife, they kind of have obviously a mind of their own of what they're going to do. So what are you given in terms of direction of what you need to get? Are there things that you are just hoping for? Or, you know, you've got situations like the sort of penguins on St. Andrew, you know, you're going somewhere like that, and you've got the walruses and that sort of stuff. Obviously, you know that the behavior of the walruses, and they might be fights. So is that something that you pre-planned of, right, okay, we're going to get that particular thing? Or do you just sort of turn up and see what you can find?
Well, so it varies a lot. So on the one end, you know, generally we'll have an idea of the species and the particular story that we're trying to tell. But then sometimes, you know, certain animals are so difficult to film and so rarely seen that literally the goal is just to film them and see what happens.
Yeah.
So in the South America episode of Seven Worlds, which was the episode that I worked on most, we were trying to film spectacle bears, which is it's like a smaller version of a North American black bear.
Right.
And they've got these big white spectacles. It's what Paddington Bear was basically. Paddington Bear from Peru.
Right.
He was a spectacle bear. Another name for them is the Andean bear, because they live in the Andes.
Yeah.
And they are so rarely filmed. I mean, most spectacle bear biologists have a handful of encounters per year or in their entire lives. Like, you just, you know, they most of them spend their time going around collecting poo or using camera traps. To actually see them in real life is incredibly difficult. And thanks to the amazing research team on Seven Worlds, in particular Sarah Wally, who was the assistant producer on the South America episode, she discovered a location in Ecuador where there was this place where about every 18 months, there was a tree that produces like a mini avocado. And about every 18 months, it sort of randomly fruits. And it's very unpredictable. It can be I say 18 months, it can be, you know, 2-year gap. It can be a 1-year gap between these fruitings. And when those fruitings happen, it brings spectacle bears in from a huge area to this one spot to concentrate. And it's actually possible to see them reliably. So we basically... Sarah had found out about this location and then got the call that the trees were fruiting and that it was all happening. So literally within the space of about a week, having first heard about it, I was on a plane to Ecuador. It was just before Christmas. We got there and it was unbelievable. I mean, I saw 10 bears in one day, which if you bear in mind how often you normally see them, was mind-boggling.
Yeah.
And in that case, the shoot started off as literally if you get a spectacle bear in the frame, that's amazing.
Yeah.
But because we were filming them so much, we started to get to know them and we could film their behavior. So we started to realize that they're really smart. So they'll eat all these little mini avocados that are near to the trunk of the tree. So they climb these big 30-meter trees to eat these fruits and they'll eat them. And once they've eaten all the ones that are easy to reach, they'll start to sort of crawl out on branches that get thinner and thinner. And when it gets to a spot where the branch is going to break, instead of walking out on that branch, they take a couple steps back. They then bite that branch, but not all the way through. So they snap it so it sort of hangs down, and then they pick the whole branch up, the end of the branch, in their teeth, bring it back to the safety of the thicker branches near the trunk, and then they start eating it. So they're really aware of, like, you know, the physics of where branches break and how best to exploit that food resource. So yeah, we went out there going, right, we're just going to try and film, you know, get the bear in frame. And then we started to learn about their social behavior and how they eat. And it was fascinating.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. And you have another similar sort of thing with the Canadian polar bears and the beluga whales as well, in terms of their behavior. I get the impression you were kind of told that they'd been seen doing this beforehand, but you managed to get to kind of go and be involved with that. And do you want to just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it was this mad behavior where these polar bears, there was a few males, big male bears, that basically had learned that if they swim out at low tide to some big rocks and they basically just fall asleep on those big rocks, particular rocks in this bay, they then wait for the tide to rise up around the rocks that they're sat on. As the tide rises, it brings beluga whales into the shallows near to these rocks. And then they wait on those rocks so that when a beluga whale is close enough to the rock, when it's swimming, the bear jumps off the rock and onto that whale. Mm. And just like the foresight and planning and just the athletic ability to be able to pull that off was nuts. And yeah, there was several accounts of guides having seen that. And it had been filmed once before, but very distantly and with a beluga calf, so a small baby. So we sort of went out there with all the toys. We were filming on a drone with a big gyro-stabilized camera so that we could film from a moving boat, but with a stable shot.
Yeah.
And yeah, we got a big male bear jumping on an adult beluga whale. So yeah, you know, unbelievable bit of animal behavior. I guess the thing that most blew me away was the foresight involved in pulling that off. You know, literally hours ahead of time, it was laying a trap. It was great to see. And I mean, whilst it was great to see, on the other hand, it's also you're watching a whale die, which, you know, these whales we'd got to know. I'd been swimming with them to film them underwater. So there was also that emotional element of it as well, which made it all the more powerful.
I was going to say, I mean, that must be quite difficult to watch in some ways. I mean, it is nature and it can be quite brutal at times. But as you say, you were there singing Adele to them as well. So, you know, it's got to be quite difficult to watch. And I mean, in a situation like that, obviously, there's no way you can get, even if you wanted to, you couldn't get in between it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And have there been situations where you've been filming stuff where you sort of could have done something, but you can't because of the fact that that's not what you're there for? You're there to film what happens.
Yeah, exactly. We're there to film natural behavior. And I think often it's usually with particularly cute animals that people have a problem with that. And my sort of argument against that is, well, nature is a lot more complex than that.
Yeah.
And if you want to base it solely on cuteness, generally the babies of predators are incredibly cute. So if you get in the way of a predation, you might be saving the prey that time, but what about the predator's babies? So if you want to use the cuteness logic, then the argument falls down.
Yeah.
And yeah, as I said, we're there to film natural behavior. And to be honest, it sounds quite brutal, but when the action is happening, I'm actually, I guess, to an extent, quite emotionally disconnected because there's a lot to think about camera-wise, whether that's flying a drone or operating a gyro-stabilized camera. You know, you're really focused. And so I don't really think about the emotions of it until afterwards, when you look back at what you've seen.
Yeah. When you are filming stuff, there must be times when you get something in shot, whether it's, I mean, there's a wonderful shot of one of the penguins. It must be an Antarctica episode. And he's got like a mohawk down the back. And you look at something like that and think, well, that's going to make it in. Because
or it's like the cameraman Rolf Steinman shot the king penguin sequence. And there was a chick that found like a penguin chick that found a big white fluff ball.
Yes.
And it's playing with it, and it's just such a wonderful moment of magic that you're like, yeah, that's TV gold.
Yeah, I mean, have you got a kind of narrative going in your head? Because they're very good with this sort of show of crafting a narrative of this animal is, or what these animals are doing. Are you just getting as much interesting shots as you can and then leaving it up to them to sort of craft the narrative afterwards, or are you trying to follow something through when you're filming it?
In the field, it's sort of a bit of teamwork between the director and the camera person. And you'll sort of work together and yeah, often you sort of start building up the building blocks of the sequence in your head, and so you think, okay, right, I got that shot. shot of the animal, you know, leaving frame in that particular direction. So, okay, so at some point I need to get a shot of the same animal doing a particular thing. And you sort of start to piece the jigsaw together, and then the director's doing that as well, and you work together to figure that out. And then back in Bristol, where it's edited, the producer then sort of starts to put that together. And then the editor is a really pivotal role in the whole thing. They can really take the footage and you know, sort of bring it to life narratively. So yeah, it's a big teamwork effort from start to finish. And then of course there's, you know, the music on top, and it all sort of adds to it.
Well, yeah, I mean the music, which I hadn't realized until I looked it up, but it's Hans Zimmer and Jacob Scheer that do the music. I mean, Hans Zimmer is a sort of legend. So, but it is incredible. I was very, because I interview quite a lot of composers doing these things, and Hans Zimmer's work is phenomenal and particularly stands out, I think, in this.
It's the tingly music, stuff that makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. It is funny when it really does take it to another level when we've come back from a shoot and we sort of want to show the rest of the team what we filmed. Often we'll just find a Hans Zimmer track, slap it on the footage and go, look, and it makes it twice as good.
Yeah, definitely a good way of doing it. In terms of some of the other stuff, there was the whale feeding in Antarctica as well, which was incredible, where they sort of all come together in one group. Were you there for that stuff?
Yeah, so what's interesting about that is that has sort of been a holy grail of wildlife film for a while, is filming a big whale aggregation in Antarctica. And they tried it on the original Frozen Planet and didn't manage to get it. And then this new data emerged, which showed evidence that there was these aggregations happening in a particular island off of the Antarctic Peninsula. And myself and director Abby Lees, we spent 2 months on a German research ship called the Polarstern with the Alfred Wegener Institute, which is like the German equivalent of the British Antarctic Survey. That's what we have in the UK. Right. And we basically spent 2 months on the boat with 30 German scientists, which was an absolute hoot. They're great fun. And there, the boat was doing krill transects. So they're basically driving up and down, measuring the abundance of krill. It's like a small little prawn that is in just billions of them in Antarctica. And the whales eat the krill. And so my job was to work with the whale research team, who we had a helicopter on the ship. And basically, if we found whales, if we sort of bumped into whales by chance during these krill transects, we'd go out to try and film them. Now, ironically, the one day in the 2 months when it all came together, the helicopter had an oil leak and it meant it was grounded. So I actually filmed most of the sequence with a drone from the ship. It was quite a funny scene because there was the helicopter sat there with a £500,000 camera system hanging off the side, which I never, you know, I couldn't use. And then I'm taking off my little drone, which next to the helicopter is dwarfed, to then buzz out to film the whales. And yeah, it was extraordinary just to see that many fin whales, could be 25 meters long plus, to see that many of them. I think there was 100, 150 of them together, see that many all together with, you know, penguins in there and albatross and seals. It was just this unbelievable feeding frenzy. And yeah, very spectacular to see. There's not many, you know, I reckon two or three times a year when I'm out filming, there's a moment when you go, wow, this is really special. And that was definitely one of them.
Yeah, it's an incredible, incredible sequence, that. And I guess with drones, I suppose in the grand scheme of things, not be doing this that long. So have drones always been around whilst you've been working now?
Well, no, they're very new. And actually, I think that's probably a key reason why I've been fortunate to be given quite a bit more responsibility than I think I otherwise would have done.
Right.
With my experience, is because sort of one of my specialties is drone stuff.
Yeah.
And I guess I've probably got one of the largest sort of ranges of experience of filming drones with wildlife, because they've only been around since I've been in the industry, which is quite lucky for me.
Yeah.
And actually at the start of Seven Worlds, a new drone system came out that sort of finally did what we needed it to be able to do in terms of the length of flight time and the stabilization technology, so we could use longer lenses on it rather than just sort of a classic wide angle, which is fine for filming pretty pictures, but you know, pretty landscapes. But if you actually want to use them to follow animal behavior, you need long flight time so you can be in the air for a long time, and you need slightly longer lenses so you don't need to be as close, so you're not influencing their behavior, which is obviously critical that we're not disturbing them.
They've
been a complete game changer. They give you a brand new perspective on many things that we think we know, and you film it with a drone and suddenly reveals a whole other world.
The leaps and bounds of where drone technology has gone in recent years is incredible, and some of the shots you get now, which even like you say 10 years ago just wouldn't be able to get, is just phenomenal across like everything at this point.
I mean, they've revolutionized the industry in that the only way of getting aerials before in a wildlife sequence was to use a helicopter, which in many instances is prohibitively expensive, and many animals you can't fly a helicopter near. Whereas now, you know, we don't go on a shoot where we don't take a drone anymore.
I mean, makes perfect sense, because I mean, a helicopter's pretty loud to get near an animal.
It's really interesting. It comes down to the species, and some animals don't like sort of the frequency that, you know, drone propellers make, and they're more tolerant of a more boomy noise of a helicopter. And a helicopter, you can put a much heavier camera on, much more, you know, a much longer lens, so you can be relatively, you know, way further away. So it all comes down to the individual situation. And this idea that drones have replaced helicopters is rubbish. They're different tools for different things.
So if you had to pick one particular sequence that you've shot out of all the stuff that you've done that really stands out to you, which one would it be?
Well, in the South America episode of Seven Worlds, which has been really exciting because that's the one that's been nominated for a BAFTA, a film with a guy called John Shire, we were filming mountain lions. And I think that was probably the standout sequence for me to work on the series, because we were walking on foot with these mountain lions. And when else anywhere in the world can you walk on foot with a big cat and the animals chill with you and you're chill that you're not going to get eaten? You know, you're not going to walk on foot with a lion in Africa and expect to film it hunting. So yeah, having that opportunity in Torres del Paine National Park in Patagonia, Chile, and that sort of backdrop, incredible mountains with these mountain lions, these pumas that we were walking alongside, was really special. And John and I sort of had a two-pronged attack where he was filming with a sort of the traditional method with a long lens on a tripod, and then I was over the top on a drone. So every situation we had, we sort of had the two angles. So yeah, we're sort of live cutting on the action.
Yeah, it sounds really incredible. As I say, I've not seen all the episodes yet, and I will go and watch that one next, because I think that sounds awesome, that episode. I could talk to you about like all this stuff all day, because I just find it really fascinating. Last couple of questions for you, and they're the same for everybody. The first question is, what TV shows are you watching at the moment?
I've just started to get into Afterlife, the Ricky Gervais Netflix show.
Oh yes, that's get the tissues ready. It's funny but heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking and hilarious. Some of the characters on that are just genius. What else am I watching? On Disney Plus, there's a National Geographic show called The World According to Jeff Goldblum.
Oh yes, that's brilliant.
He's a bizarre dude who's very funny, and it sort of looks at things that you think you know and investigates them, like ice cream or trainers. That's been an interesting one to watch.
Definitely
watching a lot more television than I normally do, because I'm not in a place where there is no TV. So good to sort of catch up on pop culture to an extent, because I'm away for months on end, often in a place where you don't get the news either.
Yeah.
About 3 years after a huge TV show has been out, or you know, some pivotal world event, someone will reference it and I'll be like, what's that? They'll be like, how did you not hear about that enormous earthquake or that TV program or that thing that happened? So yeah, I feel like I'm getting more clued up on what's going on in the world.
Yeah. Do you know what you're doing next? Are you managing to get back out there and film soon?
It's still sort of on hold. toward figuring out, making sure that we can get out and make sure we're safe, and wherever we're going, the people are safe, which is obviously...
Yes, of course. I mean, although you're generally in the middle of nowhere, but I guess the small group of you that together are really tightly packed together quite often, so...
Yeah, well, as you say, generally we are in the middle of nowhere, so that part is very safe, but unfortunately you've got to go through a lot of people to get there.
Yeah.
So that's our challenge. But no, it sounds like people are figuring it out, and in the meantime I'm sort of getting to know a lot of local British wildlife, so yeah, plenty to do.
Awesome. So last little question: if you had the opportunity to work on any TV show, can be something from the past, something present, or something future, and I guess this is a slightly different question for somebody like you that deals in a specific type of photography, but which show would it be?
I'm going to give you a really rubbish answer and not really answer your question. I guess the thing is that I'm interested in primarily in the wildlife, and the filming is secondary. Obviously I'm interested in the technology and the craft and the storytelling, but really it's the wildlife. So if I wasn't filming, I'd still be watching the animals. So what TV show? Well, it would be a wildlife one I'd work on. That's a rubbish answer.
Let's switch it slightly. Is there an area that you haven't managed to get to yet that you really want to go and film?
Tons. The list is too long to even begin. I've been lucky enough to film a few times in Antarctica now, and itching to go back, because there's some really interesting, powerful stories to tell there, and just the feeling of being there is it's addictive. Just the scale of the place and the epicness of it, and all the wildlife just like doesn't really, you know, they're not scared of people, so everything's just like right in your face. And that's a pretty unique experience for sure.
Which is fine if it's a penguin, not so good if it's a polar bear.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on and chatting with me for a bit. It's been a real pleasure. I look forward to seeing some of your other stuff as well. You've got a couple of National Geographic shows as well, haven't you?
Yeah. So I host a National Geographic online series called Wildlife, and the last season was called The Big Freeze. It was all about the Canadian Arctic. You mentioned polar bears and getting up close to them.
Yeah.
Well, we got very close to polar bears, sometimes a little too close, which was entertaining. That's all on YouTube. If you just search The Big Freeze, you can find it. But in terms of what's next, I'm working on some new projects, but unfortunately they're under very boring NDAs. So the best way, if you are interested in sort of keeping up with my stuff and what's coming out next, is to follow me on Instagram, and that's at Bertie Gregory, all one word.
Awesome. I shall go and do that. Lovely chatting with you. Have a wonderful rest of your day. I hope you manage to get out and about again fairly soon.
Thanks very much. Have a good one.
Thanks.
Cheers. Bye.